there are more people who need organs than there are organs available. That puts pressure on all sides of the organ donation equation: patients, families, and medical professionals. Joining us on the Bioethics Channel to talk about one approach to this challenge are Terry Rozelle, Rosemary Flanagan Chair at the Center for Practical Bioethics, and Rob Linderer, President and CEO of the Midwest Transplant Network. The approach is called first-person consent. And Rob, let's define what that means and how it's implemented.
Basically, first-person consent is the reflection of what the law has allowed since 1968 for donation of anatomical gifts. And it just implies that the individual has the right to make that decision and document that in a form of a driver's license or a will, or currently with the organ donor registries in Missouri and Kansas in the computer donor registry.
And in that circumstance, if consent is represented in that fashion, then a family then has no legal right to overrule that. And that's supposed to be the way it works, right?
Yes, very similar to an advance directive, in that if a person has indicated their wish through a legal gift document form that I mentioned, then it's like any advance directive, something that we would make the family aware of in a supportive way so that they would be able to carry out the wishes of their loved one.
And I understand even with that, and we just finished an attorney's roundtable here at the Center for Practical Bioethics, hospitals have made it a practice, even though it's not the law, to consult with the family before an organ donation proceeds. Does that complicate the issue a little bit?
Not really. It's very important for those of us on the organ procurement side of the equation and working with the hospitals and physicians and caregivers at the hospital to support the family. And we certainly understand the family's loss of their loved one is a tremendously difficult time, and they're fraught with grief and the emotional issues of a loss like that. Much of our experience is that the family, they're aware that their loved one, many times they already are aware, but if we're the ones that are bringing that to their attention, take comfort in that, knowing that that was their loved one's wish and that they would act on that. It's not always the case, and there are certainly circumstances that we would need to slow things down and talk with the family, make sure they understand the law and the importance of the decision their loved one made, and we would work with the hospital to support the family during that period of time before that final decision is made to recover organs or tissues.
Terry Rozelle, with the law, there's the black and white of the law, and then you get into human situations where ethics is involved. What are some of the ethics involved with first-person consent?
And even the law isn't always black and white, I'm told by lawyers who say it often depends.
You can get a yes or no answer out of those guys, can you?
Yeah. But there are a lot of ethics issues involved with organ donation, transplantation generally, where ethics consultation becomes involved. Oftentimes is when there's a conflict between persons and their values and interpretation or application of the rules. So in a case of first-person consent, we're looking now at the probably unusual situation in which someone who has died or is dying has given authorization to be a donor, but their family opposes that decision. So this is a first-person consent situation. The family legally isn't allowed to oppose, but we also have strong values of respecting families' wishes in regard to their loved ones and their bodies. And we have values, on the other hand, of helping potential recipients of the organs and tissues that might be recovered from that person who has authorized, and we respect autonomy as a deeply held value in the society and in healthcare generally. So we're weighing a lot of different values and then the rules, including the revised Uniform Anatomical Gift Act, which says families really can't legally revoke the first-person consent of the intended donor. But what happens if a family is insistent that they don't want this to go forward, and how do we resolve that with what I would call the fitting response.
So, Rob, this is a very delicate and tenuous kind of situation, and I would imagine that people in an organ procurement organization like yours are trained to how to deal with this.
Absolutely. Our staff, many come to us as professional registered nurses, social workers, and backgrounds, I think, from healthcare. So certainly have training formally in that regard, and we take advantage of many other training opportunities and working with professionals like Terry to be able to really help them grow and improve their skills and sensitivities to provide the family with the very best of care at the time when the families need care as well.
Now, this starts with informed consent, and I have on my Kansas driver's license a heart that says organ donor. And under this scenario, should I die in a traumatic kind of situation, and that is handed to my wife, and I can't recall a conversation that I've had with my wife that I do want my organs donated. The question of informed consent within the arena of a Department of Motor Vehicles, there are some questions around that, aren't there?
Yeah, there is. There's well, first I would encourage you to have a conversation with your wife.
I will after this.
Yeah, issues, but it's certainly organ donation. But with the symbol on the driver's license, in 2007, the state of Kansas updated their Uniform Anatomical Gift Act law. And that update, which modernized the language, it really has the same impact as the 1968 law, but it modernized the language to current practice. The heart symbol is equivalent to signing the back of the driver's license. And, of course, you can only get that heart symbol on your driver's license in theory, and we believe in practice. That's something we monitor closely as we can. The heart goes on the license when a person says, yes, they want to be a donor, and then that information is downloaded to the Kansas Donate Life Registry. So the presumption is that the symbol's on there. And that's since 2010, actually. The symbol was on there in 2007, but the law was updated once again in 2010, July 1st. So that information would go to a first-person consent registry. So anybody registering and getting that on their license after July 1st of 2010 would be in the registry. So we would also be able to search that database and find the information about that individual, you know, their name and key information to be able to provide to the family as evidence that they did indeed sign up in the registry and that was their intent. And we're working diligently at this point to really increase awareness about the change in the law and the fact that that decision does mean that you, you know, have made the decision to be a donor and no one after your death has the legal right to overturn that decision. And if you meet donor criteria and eligibility, that you would become a donor. Certainly not everyone can be a donor in circumstances of their death, et cetera. But that currently is the situation in Kansas. And I would encourage people not to just rely on the DMV because you can access through www.donatelifekansas.com the registry actually, and it's a very interactive registry, user friendly. I've done it, so I can attest to that. I'm not the most competent IT person or computer person, but you can log on, create your own account, your own password and ID. You can change it at any time. You can put restrictions and limitations in there, and you can revoke it, basically cancel your account if you choose as well. So it is current technology that tries to put the information where the family, where the healthcare providers, and where the OPO staff need it in the event of a person's death.
Now, even with all of that in place, you have situations where someone like Terry, as an ethicist, needs to come in, and and you attempt to resolve these issues looking at it in what you described as three different ways. What's our aim? And I'm not using a technical ethical term here, but what's our aim? Is it rules-based or is it situation-based? And I imagine all of those kind of overlap at some point as you try to work through a situation with the family.
Yes. So I too, have signed up on the online registry for Kansas. And doing so, one has to be very intentional. There's a lot of information that you can read about as to inform the person as to what they're doing, and you intentionally sign on to be a donor. But one can also be considered first-person consent upon death if you have just that little heart on the front of your driver's license. And I've already heard three or four different people in the last 3 or 4 months, including one person just today, who said, I have that heart there, and it was a mistake.
Hmm.
I told them no, and it still got on there. So the situation that arises potentially, and again, I expect this to be very rare, but it happens potentially, is where a family opposes and says, look, we don't know how that heart got on there, or we do know how that heart got on there, and she never intended. It was a mistake. And so then we could resolve the issue in a rules-based way and say, well, it doesn't really matter because the law permits us to go ahead and recover organs. And this person is on the donor registry, and the law says the family can't override that, no matter what they say. So we could resolve it that way, or we could resolve it and say, well, we hear what they're saying, and it's very likely that that's the case because it happens. But we place so much value on helping the beneficiaries, the recipients of organ and tissue donation, that we will proceed anyway because the law says so, but more importantly, because we will benefit people who will otherwise potentially die waiting on the list. And as 18 people per day die waiting on a list for an organ that they don't receive because there aren't enough organs to go around. So we could resolve it that way. I'm suggesting that another method for resolving this sort of a dilemma would be to say, in this situation, given the context of this, and given that there's reasonable doubt that this is what the person really intended, perhaps it's not worth it to proceed with recovery in this case anyway. Or there might be other reasons. Maybe the family doesn't say that they know she or he didn't mean it. But they're very, very vocal. They're very distrustful of the system. There are other reasons. They're going to go to the media or they say we have religious reasons for not doing this. It might be that we also then say this is very regrettable, but it's not worth it. We'll lose 50 potential donors for the lack of trust that will develop if we proceed with this one. Again, I think that'll be very rare, but it could happen, and I'm just trying to process ethics methodology as to how one would handle this sort of situation.
Well, Rob, it seems like we're all trying to do the right and good thing. Isn't that right? I mean, you've got your job to do, and it's a difficult one, considering all the different situations and dynamics at work. Mm-hmm. You're trying to do the right thing. The medical professionals are, and the families are, too, and trying to do right by the loss of their loved one.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think we all are, you know, collectively in our healthcare colleagues in the hospitals and transplant centers and at the organ procurement organization, IBANKS, are all, you know, certainly trying to do the right thing for and by the recipients waiting, but also equally importantly for the donor and the donor's family. Yeah, we don't look at them necessarily as separate entities. And, you know, the donor who makes a gift of donation known to us, you know, we feel it is our, you know, obligation, and certainly it's our privilege to be able to be in the work that we do. Our staff feel that across the board in our organization, that we're honoring that person's wish, and there is no greater honor than saving someone else's life or improving someone else's life through tissue donation. Yet it is important to leave that family intact so that, you know, emotionally after the egregious loss of a loved one and the grief-filled time of healing that takes place, we feel it's a successful situation if they're looking back and that they're taking some comfort in knowing, possibly even meeting a recipient of an organ or a piece of tissue that their loved one was able to provide. And, you know, that's the win-win situation. And we're really fortunate in the Midwest in particular. There's, you know, organizations like ours around the country in the Midwest, we have a very giving people, basically. I mean, we're at over 75%, so more than three out of four, or whatever that percentage is, but 75-78% say yes to donation when they have a loved one who's suitable under the circumstances of death to be able to donate an organ. And there's not many people that meet death criteria that way. Mm-hmm. You know, probably about 1 or 2 or 3%, I think, of deaths in our region are even eligible to donate organs. So it's a very small number we work with. So at the same time, we look at each case as a life, you know, potentially saved. And even though we're concerned about the loss of, you know, 50 potential donations down the road, today we have a chance to save one life. And that is as compelling and motivating to our staff in doing the right thing and working with all of our collaborative colleagues that we work with in this field to try to do the right thing every time, but certainly being sensitive to the implications, as Terry pointed out, that public trust is what makes this work, and that's why more than 75% of people who are eligible are donors, either of their own volition or their families making that decision on their behalf after their death. So very critical that not be harmed or the lack of trust come into that.
Terry, final question then. With technology doing what it does, advancing all the time, the questions are going to become that much more difficult and challenging.
They are. We wouldn't have been having this conversation 50 years ago or maybe less than that. But what doesn't change is that the way these sort of situations are prevented potentially is by talking, having conversation, having dialogue like we've had today with healthcare attorneys and with the Organ Procurement Organization and Ethics, by talking with our loved ones, our families, and communicating what it is that we want and don't want and why, what reasons we would give. It's important that we communicate with one another in the hospital setting, so that we're hearing one another when there's a conflictual situation and respecting one another and our right to disagree. So that doesn't change. Despite all the technology, we still need to do what Socrates did with students of philosophy many, many years ago, which is dialogue.
Terry Rozell is the Rosemary Flanagan Chair at the Center for Practical Bioethics. Rob Linderer is President and CEO of the Midwest Transplant Network. For more information about the Center for Practical Bioethics, visit practicalbioethics.org. That's practicalbioethics.org. My name is Laurel LeBou. Thanks for listening to the Bioethics Channel.